Hey guys, I'm Adam Rapport, and this is the Bottom Teeth Foodcast. All right, this week we've got on Alex Wagner and Mark McKinnon, two of the three hosts of the weekly Showtime documentary series, The Circus. Oh, one note, I'm old friends with Alex from my days growing up in D.C. So Mark and Alex, plus their third counterpart, John Heilman, started the series during the 2016 presidential campaign and have not stopped since. They travel around talking to key political players, and this is where our podcast comes in, eating at restaurants all across the country. We chat about how food became part of the premise of the show, what role food plays in politics, and even get some insider scoop about the eating habits of some of our former presidents. All right, let's do this. Here is Mark and Alex. Guys, first of all, I want to thank you for braving the snowstorm and making it down to One World Trade Center today.
I'm just glad I didn't have to go to school today.
I think I saw some ice in the corner of a shadow four blocks away.
It's so ridiculous.
But it seemed treacherous.
I live at 10,000 feet in the Rocky Mountains. We've had 200 feet of snow this
year. It's
been
a huge year, right?
Oh, my God. It's insane right now. I mean, they had a couple of feet just in the last 24 hours.
Where exactly do you live?
I live in Blue River, Colorado, population 800 at 10,000 feet.
Wow.
He's actually Santa Claus. That's where his workshop is. You thought Santa had a white beard.
It's paradise. It's paradise.
What's the nearest well-known skier?
Breckenridge.
Oh, Breckenridge. I grew up going to Breckenridge.
Is that right?
I mean, I want to say grew up, but as a kid, I went a few times. Yeah.
Well, my grandfather had a house there. One of my earliest memories is carrying rocks to build that house in 1961, which was the year the ski area started.
Oh, wow.
And my mother rocks. That's such a anachronism. That's like an 1800s
that's
era
like
childhood.
And he walked he walked uphill both ways to school with my
oxen. I was wearing reindeer skins on my back carrying rocks to build Breckenridge.
Yes, we need some more rocks up in here. All right. So for those listeners out there, today's February 4th, Emma?
March.
Yeah. March 4th. God. All right. So March 4th. There was supposed to have been a big snowstorm last night. Our mayor, Mr. de Blasio, shut down schools, everything else. Parents left scrambling for daycare, school, what to do today.
And it's gorgeous out.
And it's like 40 and sunny out right now. So there's a lot of angry parents in New York City right now.
De Blasio.
Including my wife right now. But speaking of snow delays, you guys are both on the road a lot for the show.
Sure.
I'm going to hit right to it. What is your favorite airport to wait out a delay at?
Wow, that's a good question.
I think of the airports I'm at almost all the time, which is Newark or Denver International.
Newark, I'm going to say no.
No, but DIA is actually pretty good. Denver.
What do you got there in terms of restaurants or bars?
John Elway's place is actually not bad.
Oh, is it a steakhouse?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's a classic John Elway Super Bowl steakhouse, you know?
Do you have a go-to order there?
Steak.
I mean, that makes sense when in Rome. I like the Austin airport.
It's pretty funky.
It's funky. Yeah.
There's live music.
They try to bring a little bit of South by Southwest inside the airport. I can't think of the food that I eat there. I just think of myself as being happy when I'm there because the Austin airport has less chain.
Yeah. They also, they open that big Stumptown coffee there, right? Kind of when you walk in, there's a big stump.
Yes. I think Wero's has an outpost out there now, and there's some real good Austin food. I mean, it's all Austin localized food in there.
Yeah.
It's not chain
stuff. They do a pretty good job. I like, interesting, some of the bigger airports, it all depends on what terminal you're in. Chicago, you can go to Rick Bayless's Torta place, but
I have.
The one I always end up at is the one that there's nowhere except for the Blackhawks bar. Where you have the foot-long hot dog, and you're like, okay.
And the cheese and the caramel popcorn. Oh my God,
who makes it?
What? That Chicago thing. All my Chicago, my husband's from Chicago.
Popcorn.
It's but, I can't believe Garrett's okay. Garrett's popcorn. Yeah.
But your husband's a healthy guy.
It may be evolving now, but wouldn't you say generally the airports are terrible places for food?
I would say they are much better than they used to be.
Definitely.
Yeah, they traditionally had been, and you would get gouged.
They're getting it now?
I think there's more individual people like the Rick Baylesses of the world being brought in there to open up their versions of what they do. It's tough for the chefs in that, I could be wrong on this, but typically, it's kind of a licensing sort of deal where they're opening it, they're bringing the food in, but then it's the airport people who staff it and whatnot, and security clearance and all those sort of things. So you got to sort of try to make it as good as you can, but you're still sort of playing by airport rule as well there.
But I feel like generally airlines and air travel, they're trying to make at least more of a hat tip towards good food.
Yeah.
On the Delta LAX flight, John and Vinny of John and Vinny's amazing
In L.A.,
pizza
I was just in L.A.
jam.
Interviewing them about that.
Well, how symbiotic? What beautiful synchronicity.
So
they do the menu for the L.A. New York flight, right?
For the fancy business class. Yeah, they do L.A. New York and Boston New York. And Linton Hopkins down in Atlanta does it going west for Delta, and then New York to L.A., Danny Meyer's restaurant group does that.
Wow, really?
This has nothing to do with politics, but it's good
stuff. It has to do with
talk, travel,
though.
It's interesting. I at Bon Appetit, for instance, the magazine, because we know we have the podcast and the videos and this and that, but within the at the magazine, anytime I remotely bring up politics, it's just like the angry handwritten letters start just pouring in. Like, stick to food.
Stick with what you know, Rappaport.
Yeah. And, in one sense, I'm like, I get it. If I'm sort of sitting down with a magazine, you kind of want this sort of escapist moment for the month. But on the other moment, it's like, in a lot of ways, food is politics.
Well, the one great thing about food, and I'll tell you the history of how it came to the show, but that's the one thing everybody agrees on. You know, in this partisan, vile, hyperbolic environment, when we do the food stuff, people are all love, man.
Yeah.
It's all love. It's great.
Well, and people, you go to red states or blue states, and there's a dish or a restaurant.
Oh, they all want to.
I mean, I often find, like, when you're interviewing a politician and you've gone to some place that is not your usual place to hang out or whatever, and you're in an environment that's foreign or hostile, or you're talking to someone who's prepared for, you know, a tough interview or a shakedown, if you start talking about food, mm-hmm. or if you just say, you know, an amazing blah, 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 like pork sandwich at this spot, like, it just immediately establishes common humanity.
Yeah.
And it's really underrated as a way to, I mean, food does bring people together literally at the table. But in politics, it's like one of those things that in our fiercely partisan time, like you said.
I am shocked by the response we get to the food stuff in our show. I mean, there's just a whole food porn audience.
Yeah,
out
I mean,
there
is something visceral.
I mean, that
about
may not surprise
it.
You.
Yeah,
but
when you're at the barbecue joint and people are like, oh, ribs and mac and cheese and cobbler, and like, you can't not react to it. But it's interesting not to get all partisan again. But one thing Obama said a few years back about these times where we're at each other's throats is just like he said. Typically, like people tend to have much more in common than you think. It's only when you bring up politics that then they get combative.
Yeah.
But and if you look at those like barbecue joints in Texas that you've been at in one episode of the show or in Carolina, you never think about who's eating there and what side of the aisle they're on.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like they just want some Carolina-style ribs or they want some Texas-style brisket, and everyone's in the church of barbecue at that point.
Absolutely. Now, that's the one common thing that brings everybody together.
So whose idea was it to start filming segments in restaurants? Was that one of you guys? Was it a producer?
The way it started was we knew we had to set up the week somehow, and the conventional idea would be we'd be in some kind of studio setting at a desks and sitting there. That was just horribly static and not in line with kind of the feel of our show, which is very documentary and very loose and fun. And I think somebody just suggested, why don't we grab a lunch, and then we went down to like Katz's Delicatessen. That was one of the first ones here in New York.
But yeah. I think it's another piece of it is if you're a journalist covering politics or if you're a campaign staffer, you crisscross the country and eventually you remember spots you've been to as like, oh man, when we hit Austin, we got to go to this spot. Like when we do our press availability here, we got to make sure to get a sandwich here.
Lizard's Thicket.
Columbia, South Carolina.
Well,
yeah, Columbia and Charleston are great places to stop. You're there in, primary time. Everybody has their institutions that they make pilgrimages to, no matter where they're from and whether they're on the media side or the campaign side. And so I think the show wanted to capture that thing of like, we all pick places we want to go to and we have to go to these places.
But do you feel like when you're, especially during the campaign trail and whatnot, are there certain joints that are more like red joints or blue joints in terms of where the media or the campaign people, workers will go to? Any examples of that, like clubhouse-wise?
And I think to your earlier point, food is a place that brings everybody together. Now, there's more, you know, if we're in redder states, there are going to be redder people there, you know. And, you know, we don't go to Chick-fil-A where we know what kind of constituency that's going to be.
I think, you know, there's a dividing line. Part of it is economics, right? Like the journalists tend to be broker, so they'll find the hole in the wall spots in any given city. Campaign staff tends to have less time to be going. I mean, I'll let you speak to this, Mark, since you're on the campaign staff side. There's less time in between that you're on the road with the candidate.
And fast and furious, just getting it and grabbing it and throwing it down. And, you know, we're into lowbrow as much as highbrow. I mean, I love good lowbrow.
But I always think that in terms of making a magazine every month, that's kind of everyone. There's this notion that fancy people just want, or rich people only want fancy food. Like, no, rich people want to go to the best barbecue joint in Austin also. Rich people want the best mac and cheese, and like it goes both ways. And there's this notion that, only certain types of people like certain types of food is, I think, a complete misnomer.
Yeah, it is for sure.
So you worked on campaigns for a long time, correct?
I did.
So talk to me about that, and like, is it when you're on the campaign and do you even have time to eat, or what is that process like? And if you could share some stories for various candidates.
Well, McCain was kind of a classic who was always living off the land, you know, because first time around he didn't have any money, and then second time around when he was the front runner, and then he got, you know, then he went broke overnight, and so we were living off the land in New
Hampshire. Did he like gamble it all in Vegas or something?
Pretty close, you know. Yeah, but he got caught in the crossfires of the immigration debate and went from front runner to, you know, dead last overnight. And so we had to go literally live off the land in New Hampshire. And so
you guys were foraging?
Yeah, wait, what does that literally mean, live off the land?
Well, I remember, you know, we'd have enough money to get to the next day.
Yeah.
And we were eating burgers and fries and living in and staying at hotels that were under construction.
So you weren't going to Morton's Steakhouse?
No.
Did McCain have good eating habits?
No.
Did he have particular eating habits?
No, I mean, he just was kind of an old Navy guy. He would have lived off, you know, GORP.
Right.
And that's kind of how the whole thing rolled. But the whole thing about campaigns is you eat whenever possible. Mm-hmm.
Because you don't know when you're going to get to eat
again. Yeah, and you go to the bathroom whenever possible, and you sleep whenever
possible.
And
you charge your phone
whenever possible. Yeah, and you just don't know when you're going to get to do any of those things. So, I mean, the sort of mandatory thing is, like, have a stash in your bag of something, like nuts and berries. Oh, yeah.
What about George W. Bush? I feel like he is more disciplined about his diet and health and fitness generally, right?
Yeah, I mean, but he's a Texan, and, you know, he loves his
red meat. So, what does that mean?
Barbecue, steak. You know,
not
a big vegetable guy.
No. I remember being with him in Kennebunkport. It was one of my favorite moments politically ever.
But the thing is, he's not a Texan.
Well,
he bought in
by address.
He's lived there 90%.
What do they always say? Like, converts are the biggest zealots or whatever.
Yeah, for sure.
So he's an enthusiastic.
I remember being with the whole family and his mother. Like, eat your peas, George. Eat your peas.
He literally said that as an adult.
While he was campaigning for president.
Yes,
that's incredible.
Yes, and just berating him for that, and also that he ate too fast.
Well,
he's a speed eater.
I know that.
He does everything fast.
My wife literally still tells me that all the time. She's like, will you slow
just chew
down?
I tell that to my husband.
Is that a male affliction?
Yes.
I fear it is, except for my cousin Tony, who you know.
Slowly?
Cousin Tony. Like, he eats so slowly that you'll have had seconds and he's still working on his first. He's just talking the entire time and he eats really slow. It's a sort of double whammy. Wags, you've spent a lot of time with our last president, Obama.
Seven Almonds Obama?
Yeah.
repeat that anecdote.
Give me the yin and yang of like healthy, highbrow Obama and yummy, digging in, lowbrow Obama.
Okay, well, I'm not like the Obama food chronicler by any stretch of the imagination, but I can say, since my husband did cook for him for 6 years, actually seven, you know, they have a very balanced attitude towards food. I mean, like, she is by far the more adventurous eater. And, like, and if you actually follow the exploits of, like, which Obama goes out to the cool restaurants, she's always paving the way.
So she's the one choosing.
She's, she's, like, always down to try the new. We just filmed this week's episode. We started the roundtable at Maidan Maydan?
Maydan in Washington, D.C. Yeah. It was our number two best new restaurant in America last
oh, really?
Year in
we,
Washington, D.C.
It was fantastic.
It's amazing, and it's so unlike Washington. It's so un-Washington, and she went there really early
yeah.
and kept going back, and she just gets down with all kinds of different stuff. Now, I think because of his childhood in Indonesia, he can really get into spicy and like, I think particular Asian food is like his Proustian Madeleine, you know, like that Anthony Bourdain episode
yep.
where they're eating noodles. I remember talking to him about it and like, it conjures such specific memories for him. There's such a emotional link to like Asian noodles
yeah,
and
yeah.
We're doing noodles tonight. I'm very excited.
Yes, we're going to Momofuku in Columbus. Mm. The noodle
bar.
Up
oh,
in Columbus,
the Columbus Circle.
The new one, yeah.
Oh, cool.
But he told me once about nasi goreng and like he just went off on like the details of nasi goreng and what it was like growing up in Indonesia and eating nasi goreng and the condiments and this and that. And then he started talking about char siu pork. And he just like has a real literacy around
yeah.
Asian food that
so
I, as a half Asian person.
Can we get to the almond story? It's apocryphal,
oh, yes.
right?
Well, so, but he's.
But it's been an inspiration
at
to people
the same
like me.
Time. He's not, I mean, he's just very. His general diet, I think, is in line with his personality. He's never too high, never too low, never eats too much, doesn't eat too little, keeps it really like in line. And so when he has a snack, he doesn't have like a whole bag of almonds, he has a
yeah.
handful. And I think a story that was told about his almond consumption was misconstrued in the press, according to my husband who told the story. He does not count out the number of almonds he eats
right,
every
right,
night.
Right, yeah.
He just does not eat a lot.
So there well, might have been like, I mean, he'll eat like seven almonds, like that sort
exactly.
of.
That's what
and
it was.
Then he'll
that was
eat
the story.
Like seven almonds so, became, he will eat seven almonds at like 11:32.
So I do want to say that that's inspired me to a habit that I have a daily ritual now. I eat 10 Reese's Pieces a day. I do. I have a bowl.
Wait, at what?
Reese's Pieces.
Reese's Pieces.
Is
that's
that,
insane.
Is that like throughout?
That's, how do you count that out?
Is that throughout the day?
I do 5 in the morning and 5 in the afternoon.
Oh, my,
oh
God,
my God.
That's psychotic.
Okay. So, yeah. So, if George W. Bush and Obama were to have a wrestling match, who would win?
That's such a weird thing
well,
to
they're
say.
Well, they both seem pretty disciplined. They both are athletic.
This is about, I mean.
It's about the same height?
No, Obama's taller, I think.
I think Obama's a little taller.
Obama will tell you. He'll be the first to tell you, point you to his health, his physical at the end of his presidency. He's like the only president in history whose resting heart rate went down, whose body fat
really?
Went down, like his anaerobic threshold went up. I mean, he got into better shape
well, you know,
at the end of his presidency.
I used to run with the president before he was president, and then his knees.
Which president are we talking about here?
President Bush. yeah. Before, and then his knees went out, my back went out, so we started mountain biking. When he was president, he mountain biked, I mean, that was his release. And he mountain biked like a madman.
Like,
I mean,
where? Where were you mountain
there are these,
biking?
There's like these secret security compounds in and around D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of built out some single track.
So you weren't doing like the really dangerous stuff where you're kind of going off little boulders and all that sort
no,
of stuff.
No, but it's I mean it's pretty edgy. I mean it was true mountain biking
yeah.
and he's a pretty good mountain biker.
So how,
but he ride fast as hell. And like, I remember one time this is an example, but he did it as a release, which all presidents need in some form or fashion. I remember one Sunday he called and said, you know, MK, let's go. And I was like, Mr. President, it's 17 degrees, and it's like going to, you know, the forecast is for sleet in 10 minutes. He's like, perfect. And so we went out for 2 hours in sleet.
2 hours?
In the sleet?
In the sleet in 17 degree weather. And when we were done.
What time of day is it? It's like middle of the afternoon?
No, this is like 8 in the morning.
Oh, my God.
And it was just horrible. And you know how when you get so cold that when you start to thaw it, it like hurts, feels like needles
yeah.
in your.
Oh, my
if I hadn't been, if I hadn't been with the President of the United States, I would have cried. I was in such pain.
Wow.
Yeah. And I had icicles all over my beard. I was just like a.
So you
like,
really look like Santa
like
Claus.
Santa, yeah.
That's like that Tony Soprano thing. Like, the boss says we're doing this. You're like,
oh,
all
yeah.
right, boss.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah.
How
absolutely.
Michael Cohen of you.
Totally.
Whatever the boss
yeah.
says.
Do you remember what you ate after that 2 hour workout?
I think I just stuffed, you know, whatever was around and just consumed. It was like I had bars and chocolate and just
anything.
Just anything that would go down as fast as possible.
You know, interestingly enough, the woman the chef who is the executive chef at the White House.
So explain the difference between what your husband Sam Kass did and what the executive chef of the White House does.
The executive chef of the White House oversees all the sort of formal functions, state dinners, etc.
Any event.
And Sam was unusual. Other presidents didn't have a Sam Kass, but he was the personal chef to the family. And then he also ran food policy in the West Wing. So he had two jobs, but his first job started out as their chef. So he didn't do state dinners. He would help out. But the woman, the executive chef of the White House, is a woman named Christetta Comerford, who was there during George W. Bush and is still there through Donald Trump. She's like the longest serving sort of I don't know that she's the longest serving, but she's sort of shepherded through three very different palates. Right. Sam told me they came in after the Bushes left and it was a really seamless, beautiful transition. But, you know, there was like Velveeta and like stuff that the Obamas weren't going to eat because they were trying to eat really healthily and they had two young daughters and they were trying to focus on that. And now Trump, as we know, is like, you know, meatloaf and McDonald's and through all of it, Christetta Comerford has been there like cooking meals for the public and for at least the Bushes and the Trumps.
So whatever the first family wants.
Yeah.
I took a tour of the White House one time. Sam was gracious enough to hook us up and went down to the kitchen. It's kind of fascinating how it's a very workmanlike kitchen, the big sort of industrial ranges, but not big.
Small.
And then when you go to the room where the state dinners are, like they pack the people in there. And it's like, what, 150 or something maybe?
Yeah, that sounds right.
And it's just like boom, boom, boom. And as soon as the plates are down, then they're done. The boom, 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 moving them out. And like very little room for the waiters to get by. And like that you could understand a chef like her, like someone needs to be in charge who knows how things run.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, the White House surprises everybody because it's so, you'd think it would be this enormous sort of, you know, so the working space and the dining space, it's all really cramped and tight and terrible and, you know,
miserable.
Like hundreds of years old.
Because it's limited real estate. And also, everyone was a lot smaller back in the day. I'm kidding. That's not
it's true.
But they were smaller operation,
too. But if you look at, in America at least, I mean, I'm not going to speak for Versailles or something, but if you're ever anywhere in New England and you go to houses from the 1700s or 1800s, the ceilings are very low and the doorways are smaller. And it's just a lot smaller blueprint for living. And the White House was not unlike that. And then obviously having to pack in all the employees and the events and this and that. And it's just like they really jam it in there.
During the state dinners, one of the things that I think is so interesting is the plates get put down. But as soon as the president is finished, the plates are cleared. And Bush was
that
very
means they
calm.
Were done in 5 minutes.
Well, it was a thing with the White House staff that Bush was such a fast eater that, you know, he'd get his plate first and that he'd finish like in record time. And so there were some guests who hadn't even gotten their plates yet they started clearing.
And you just could never catch up.
You that's why
here's your dessert.
Mama Bush was like, slow down and eat your piece.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
It's interesting. We were talking about the sort of the common ground of food and how it brings people together and how we can all agree upon it. There have been some of these instances in the last year as things have really heated up, particularly with immigration and the wall. And like, yeah, interesting. I want to say it was Kirstjen Nielsen getting sort of heckled and yelled at a Mexican restaurant during the time of, you know, when
Ted
mothers
Cruz
and children
did.
Being separated.
Yeah.
It's happened to a number of people.
And that happened to, who was that? The Red Hen, not the Red Hen.
Well, it was Huckabee Sanders.
Yeah, it was Sarah Huckabee Sanders, yeah.
Kicked out of a restaurant, the Red Hen, in Lexington, Virginia.
Yeah.
I want to say that, I mean, that seems
that's
to be
crossing
new,
the line.
Right?
Yeah, that's, it's definitely new. And it's, and I think it's just really crossing the line.
Well, I think you also have to understand, you know, for Secretary Nielsen, immigration and immigration policy directly affects a lot of kitchens, right? There are a lot of undocumented workers that work in kitchens, restaurants. The dynamic there is directly affected by whatever our national policy is. And so, you know, that was a really emotional time. It continues to be emotional as that saga, you know, sort of plays out in slow motion. But I think that was one of those situations where it was like, how dare you come to a restaurant where there are a lot of workers from Latin America. I think it was it a Mexican restaurant?
It was a Mexican restaurant, MXDC Cocina Mexicana,
right,
in Washington, D.C.
Why, like, come and sort of celebrate and consume, you know, it the was bounty a, of it, Mexican it, culture it was, at the same time as you are sort of vilifying, you know, all the people south of the border. I'm not excusing it, but I'm just saying, you know, that these are really sort of particular expressions of the political moment. And I think also, Mark, you can attest to this. This White House, you know, it's hard to get access to these people in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah,
media has
yeah.
become so bifurcated that, like, they're on Fox News and nowhere else. So
right.
when you see someone in the
you
flesh,
you want to express
and you
what you've been wanting
exactly.
to express for a long time, sure. But then that gets into the whole, like, doxing where you're, like, publicly outing people's home addresses.
Yeah.
And, you know, people like Tucker Carlson, people going to their houses and banging on their doors. And it just.
Right.
That's taking the public discourse way off the path.
How on the show, so let's talk about the show for a bit. So for those viewers who have not seen it, weekly kind of docu-series.
Documentary.
What's going on
it's
right
a,
now in
it's
politics.
A real-time documentary. And what that means is that we do in a week what people would normally do in months or even longer, which is we create a 30-minute documentary every week. And the part of the reason that it works, I think, is A, first of all, there's just so much interest in what's going on. No lack of material.
Yeah.
What makes good drama?
There's literally too much material.
Well,
right
we
now.
Have to cut every week. And we've never had not enough material, which I was afraid would happen at the beginning.
Why not an hour?
We've tried to do that on a couple of occasions, and we have done a few. It crushes us to do 30 minutes. I mean, first of all, I pitched the show for 10 years. Television executives didn't think we could do what we're doing technically.
In terms of the turnaround time?
Yeah.
It's so fast.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
How much was Hard Knocks an influence in terms of
partially
being able to do it?
Yeah, I was to say, listen, you know, you can do it on Hard Knocks, and we should be able to do it here. And David Nevins, who was head of Showtime, had some experience in that kind of turnaround, and he was one of the first people to say, you know what, let's do it.
Hard Knocks being the NFL football show where they follow
but
a
you
team
see,
in training camp,
but
and
you
they, every, that week,
yeah.
they film it that week, it's on that.
And the challenge for a network executive is when we were pitching this, they said, wait a minute, you're telling me I'm going to see the show that airs Sunday night, Sunday morning? I don't think so. You know, that was their reaction. But Showtime and Nevin said, let's roll, let's do it. It's a bit of a gamble, but it's exceeded all our wildest expectations. We thought it'd be just the campaign, one and done, maybe come back in 2020, and then a week into the administration, like, get back out there.
So, all right, a couple questions. So, in terms of the actual schedule, so you film from when to when, and when's it edited, and then when does it go up?
We start filming generally on Mondays, like today. We'll start to do our roundtable, which is the food scene, to kind of set up the week, and then we roll constantly. We have three or sometimes four big crews of big cameras, big sound. That's, you know, five, six, seven people per crew, all with each one of the co-hosts, all over, you know, sometimes all over the country. And the reason we can do it now and couldn't do it 5 years ago is we're feeding back media real time. It's not like FedExing a half-inch tape overnight or two nights. As soon as it's shot, it's fed back to New York, and editors start working on it immediately.
Oh,
so
they're like running.
They'll be cutting tonight what we shoot. And so by Wednesday or Thursday, we'll start, and sometimes Friday, we see like two-thirds of the first, you know, two-thirds of the show, rough cut. And then we give feedback, and then Saturday morning, we see a longer cut. Then we always stay up all night Saturday night, usually until about 7 or 8 or 9 a.m. Sunday morning.
I don't think
to finish.
I don't
it.
Do it.
She gets a pass.
Adam didn't even know, but he knew. He was like, I know Alex Wagner, and she's not staying up.
She's had like two glasses of Merlot and like, yeah.
Well, this season, Alex Wagner, and last season, actually, I'm pregnant. So I have a completely valid excuse in my mind. And then other seasons, I'm just lazy.
So it's March. When do you have to stop traveling?
Like
soon.
Don't tell my doctor.
Yeah.
Yesterday.
Yeah,
soon. Like, we only have two more weeks left of this season. So I'll be able to like do small trips through the end of the season.
And then, so I guess in that sense, I mean, from what I heard, the first 2020 Democratic debate is in June or something.
Yeah,
that's just insane. Yeah. Why, I don't want to get started on like the media machine that is a presidential election these days. So will the next, I mean, will you do two seasons on the campaign then next year? I mean, if it, how long?
We'll go almost all year next year.
Well, yeah, we haven't gotten our marching orders from Showtime, but we will definitely have more of an extended
You'll
run
start
in 2020.
Next fall.
Well, we did
this fall.
We'll do this fall, and then next year we'll go like 26 episodes, like we did the first campaign, which is, you know.
We think we've not finalized.
Well, I'm just comparing it to 2016, which was 26 episodes.
Right, it'll be similar to that.
And it just seems like there's a natural storyline to follow during an election. How is it when there's not an election going on like right now? How do you craft
the
storylines?
The one thing I'll say about this administration and this time that we're in, first of all, there's a national civics lesson going on. People are just fascinated by what's going on and interested, and that's across the political spectrum. The other thing is that what makes great drama? Interesting characters, conflict, and surprise. We get that every single day. You know,
I mean, like I said, too much of it. That's why it's the half hour show. Well, like, it seems like you could easily. Yeah.
Well, we could listen, but
if you
there's
have
enough
you have to
material.
Yourself.
And but it's happening so fast and so furious that sometimes we're at Thursday and Friday and the stuff we shoot Monday or Tuesday seems ancient.
Well, how often does that happen? Because you hear that a lot on podcasts like Pod Save America and those guys. By the time a pod goes up, they're like, darn, we like something else already broke. And now this is going to sound late, even though it's only literally a day old.
But I actually think that's the strength of the show. I think in this moment, especially politically and in terms of the way we cover what's happening politically, you need something. You need a digest at the end of the
week.
That's
what I was going to say.
I mean, you actually need a reminder of like...
what was important.
Something that helps you synthesize these times. Like having a weekly documentary, I think, is actually critical to all the other media you may consume through.
Because everything else is a fire hose. It's a fire hose of cable stuff with something happening every 5 minutes, every hour. And so people are just bombarded by this information. And people are kind of understandably addicted to it all because it's so fascinating and interesting. But it's hard to tell what mattered. At least we get to take a step back and present it in kind of a fun, loose documentary style with kind of a thematic backbone to it to say, you know, and tie it up into a narrative.
There's a little distance,
line.
A little exhale. Yeah, I don't.
Yeah,
I
also think like we had three episodes in the fall or in and around the Kavanaugh confirmation that I think really captured the emotional battle that was playing out in a way that you couldn't, the cable news coverage and network news coverage didn't, but in part because they were just kind of responding to what happened that day. But we were able to really synthesize the moment in a way that I think was not only compelling, but really useful as we sort of process, okay, where is the country at? Like, what does this debate actually mean? Like, where are we? And I think the show is really, really helpful and useful for that.
So tonight you're mentioning you're going to go to the new Momofuku up at Columbus Circle.
Sure.
Time Warner Center. So that you're going to record there?
Mm-hmm. We're going to shoot there.
The three of you guys. So, yep. All right. So you're sitting around a table. Are you pretending to have dinner? Are you actually having dinner? Like, what is that like?
There's so many.
We're
shoveling food in our mouths, me more than anyone else. Every Saturday they show us a cut, and every Saturday I'm like, I am just chewing food with my mouth open. You need to take these shots out of the show.
Haven't you learned by now how to eat on camera?
You'd think. I would. There is no good eating. I mean, with the exception of, how do you eat ramen on camera?
You got to slurp. You got to embrace the slurp.
I mean, like, with a knife and fork.
Do you get to film the segments at least when it is like naturally dinner time? Or is it we're going to pretend to be eating dinner at 2:30?
No.
Pretty close.
It's dinner time.
I know we're always doing it when I'm hungry, so.
Yeah, we are legitimately eating and legitimately drinking. I'm not this season, but these guys are. And
it is great food. I mean, these places we get to go are.
Who gets to choose the restaurants?
I will just say that I'm kind of the food idiot. I'm the guy from Colorado and, you know, the bland Colorado Midwesterner. Between Alex and John, they're the big foodies. And so it's a big experiment for me. I'm eating all the stuff that I've never had before.
We have a big crew, and so not every restaurant can accommodate us because we do eat at mealtime. And so,
see, that I would be very conscious if I'm in a restaurant and there's lights and cameras on me where other customers are around. I'd be like, oh, God, I'm such a jerk. Sorry for bothering you people. We're going
to
shoot this.
We've learned to get past
that. You're just like, whatever.
And you should see us on Capitol Hill when we're barging into senators' offices. We don't put up a ton of lights. I mean, when you see the show, it looks, we want the way the restaurant appears on screen to be what it is like when you walk into the restaurant. So we don't like...
It's not a set.
Yeah, it's not a set. But yeah, we're in there and we have cameras and that's annoying maybe to some diners. We try and keep it tight. Like after we finish, we get out of there.
Okay, how often... So you're like the big TV political people come in, you got the cameras going and all of a sudden like, oh, the chef would like you to try so-and-so and the chef sends out something. They never send out something?
They never send stuff out, do they?
What?
Well, there's kind of a hybrid on that, which is usually when we go, like tonight, it's just we said, just give us the best stuff you got.
Oh, so we just load the table.
Yeah,
just,
and we want stuff that looks good.
Yeah,
all right,
just
I'm going to ask both of you this question. All right, Mark, weirdest thing you've eaten in the last year on camera? Where you're like, I don't want to be rude. I guess I should try this.
Oh, I'm trying to think of that weird seafood stuff we had near the golf course in Florida.
Oh, God, what was that place called? It's on the list.
Was it alligator?
What seafood stuff?
Seafood stuff.
I just remember something that John was playing with that came like out of the bowl. And
tentacles involved?
Yeah. Was it like a ceviche?
Tentacles, like, yeah, so it was like eel or something.
Was it like, was it like an octopus ceviche?
I think it was eel.
On a golf course? That sounds like a bad...
It was a weird
Florida
thing. It was very Florida.
Very Florida. Wags, what about you?
What is the weirdest thing?
Or not say weirdest.
It was at Major Domo, probably in L.A.
Mm. Boy, that was great.
And there was amazing stuff. But I feel like it was like... Was it an oyster-based thing? I probably shouldn't have eaten it, even if I... Let me rethink
this.
While
pregnant.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a real DRH.
I had that one time. Simone and I were in Paris years ago when she was pregnant with Marlon, and we went to that restaurant, Le Comptoir de Relais, a little bistro-y place, like very affordable, but anyways, prefixed, you can get in. I mean, it was the entire menu was like... Or it was like beef tartare. There was like tuna tartare, like rare beef, whatever, oozy cheese. And like we were sitting next to this French couple, both of them were doctors. And the one was like, oh, no, that's fine. You can eat that. Just don't eat the goat cheese, but otherwise everything's fine. Like, yeah, no big deal. Like raw eggs, everything.
It is
true.
There are definitely different standards depending on what country you are in. I mean, Japanese women are pregnant and eat sushi. And
that's true.
They're still a country of Japan. The procreation continues.
There still is a country.
I'm not answering your question very well.
What about drinking? How much drinks will you do on camera?
I mean, when I wasn't pregnant,
Wagner's an A-League drinker, man. She gets into the mezcal and
oh my god, yeah, there were definitely some shoots where I was like,
she's a professional
on camera.
but that's what they have editing.
Can I also say one of the reasons we shoot in bars and restaurants is because the show is kind of no bullshit, right? It's not about sitting in a well-lit studio asking people like questions from a notepad. It's about giving the viewer a sense of like the sort of the real, the high human drama, as we say, of American politics. And that involves like getting to humanity. And part of the way you get to humanity is by getting people drunk. Yeah. But it's true though, like having in an interview with Andy McCabe at the Breslin, right, the former FBI director, is going to be a much looser, better interview, even if you're not drinking, than Andy McCabe sitting in a television studio somewhere. Yeah. It's immediately disarming.
And people are just as passionate about their drinking, about our drinking,
yes,
and what they think we should be drinking. You know, I mean, just...
Are you a whiskey guy?
Yeah.
Like, what, do you have a particular brand?
I'm a little throwback. I like a Maker's Mark, which is kind of the old classic standby, but I love it. I love up Maker's Mark Manhattan. I have kind of a bastardized Manhattan, which is no bitters. It's half and half instead of 3-1,
okay,
which it normally would be, and no bitters.
So it's just sweet
vermouth and Maker's Mark.
Do you do it up, rocks, shake?
Up cold, up really cold.
Really cold,
Super cold, like ice floating on the top.
So you shake it.
Yeah.
Do you do the cherry
in there?
Which
purists probably wouldn't like. I do like the cherry. I like the real cherry, though.
The Luxardo ones?
Yes,
the really syrupy ones?
Yeah,
those are good. Those are not a fort. Those are actually, Simone was complaining to the little place near us that they needed to get Luxardo cherries in the little grocery. So they got some and they're like $34 a jar. And she's like, maybe I'm not going to buy the little Luxardo cherries. Sorry.
I'll throw one. I'm also a big vodka guy and
I have to throw a shout out
to Tito's in Austin, Texas.
Oh, yeah. Texas is
love, love a Tito's martini.
How do you take a martini also?
Really cold up lemon twist. Again, ice on the top.
I've definitely consumed that with Mark off camera. Like he is a real legit bona fide. He and his wife do that awesome thing of couples like sitting down and having a martini before dinner.
I need to hang out with you guys. What about
I went to the Hay the other day and they
Hay Adams.
AKA the hey.
Sorry.
Hey.
I had to do that.
I had a single martini there that just destroyed me. It was huge and it was so good.
Yeah, the giant trough size ones.
I don't like it. They get too warm.
Well, yeah. I usually can go for two, but if I'd had two of that, I wouldn't have walked out.
The best martini in my mind is Musso and Frank in LA, where they give you the back, the half of the martini.
The little caddy and the little ice bowl sometimes.
Exactly.
That's really cute.
Such a little sidecar. Beautiful.
Yeah. Do you have like a day drink if you're not just going straight up alcohol, you know, something a little softer to kind of get you through the afternoon?
No, I go straight up hard stuff early.
Do you really? He had wine once when we were at a coffee shop filming a round table. I was like eating tomato soup and Mark had like white wine.
Well, I do this two ways. The first whole season, I quit drinking for the whole year.
No fun.
Explain that. Well, I'm a little older than the rest of my colleagues. Yeah. And I was just afraid I couldn't keep up because we're going to bed at, you know, we're getting into hotels 11 midnight. You go to the bar till 2 and we're out at 5 in the morning.
It'll wear you out.
If you're doing like that year, we were doing 26 episodes the whole year. I just said, I'm not going to make it. So I just went dry that whole year. And then the next year I said, listen, screw it. I'm going to drink heavily. Yeah. And I drank heavily.
And your wife, your wife was like, honey, you're no fun.
Yeah, I'm much more fun when I drink.
Yeah, it's also you need something to numb the pain. I mean, it's hard. The show is hard to do. It's exhausting.
It's a grind. All right, so this episode goes up March 13th, which means you have one episode left.
The season finale.
Season finale.
The mid-season finale.
Mid-season. I guess. What is mid-season finale?
Because we come back in the fall.
Okay, yeah, sure.
So this is season 4, and that's the first half of this season.
But one can go on to like Showtime On Demand.
Of course, yes. And we highly encourage it.
You can watch 50 episodes of our show.
Oh, my God. And then but come fall 2019, at that point, we'll be in full
swing
campaign mode.
Yeah.
And Wags, you're going to have 2 children at home.
She'll be pregnant again.
Yeah. No, God, no. The bakery's closed. The bar is closed. Last call right here. I will say, people are like, how are you going to do it with 2 young children? And I'm like, how could I possibly raise 2 young children? I have to go out on the road.
She's going
to
leave them.
Outsource.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to raise them if you don't have to do it.
You know what? Look, they're very little. I have an incredible husband, an incredible nanny, an incredible family.
Fortunately, he doesn't travel much.
Yeah, right. And like, I will tell you one thing about the circus. It is, I think I've done a number of TV projects in my very young life, and it is definitely the thing I'm the most proud of. It's the hardest thing. It's the most rewarding. I don't think it's like anything else on television, and it really does offer you that front row seat to what's happening in politics. I mean, we are really living through history. If nothing else, this is a hugely illuminating time in terms of our values, are the way we sort of shape and preserve our democracy, and I'm very lucky to be able to have a ticket for the ride.
Absolutely. All right, MCAT, I'm going to call you MCAT. Can I call you MCAT?
Yeah.
If George W. calls you MCAT, I want to call you MCAT. And Alex Wagner, thanks for coming, guys.
Thanks, Adam.
Kick it hard. Glad to be with you. Thank you.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.